all day long, so it's probably pretty easy to just let it slip even when someone isn't intending anything by it.
It's probably true. You get that level of followers, you're bound to get a bunch of trash thrown your way all the time.
Yep.
Hello and welcome to the Feather Podcast, brought to you by the best feather on the web for the feather format, EDH Feather. My name is Joey Feather, and I'm joined today by my feather co-hosts.
Wow.
I refuse to answer to that.
Okay, in all seriousness, welcome to the EDH Retcast, everybody. I'm really excited about the card feather, and I'm joined today by the delightful Matt Morgan.
So Joey, I had a joke lined up for you, and now you've just gone and ruined it.
I'm quite all right with ruining your jokes.
I'm just going to float away like the end of Forrest Gump while Robert Zemeckis rolls across the screen.
Like a feather? I absolutely love it. I'm also joined by Dana Roach.
I am the Razia Boros Archangel of this podcast in that I cost 119 mana to cast and I'm not any good.
And I'm Joey Schultz. And here on the EDH Retcast, we're going to give all that deck building data on EDH Rec just a little more context. Ladies and gents, we have a guest with us on the podcast this week. You may know him from his fantastic articles on Star City Games. It's Benny Smith.
Hey there. Thanks for having me on.
Welcome, Benny.
Yeah, Benny, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm pretty stoked. I listen to you guys all the time. So being on board is pretty cool.
That's really awesome. So for some folks who may not be in the know, how about you introduce yourself a little bit and let us know who you are and how you relate to all of this awesome Commander content?
Okay. Well, my name is Benny Smith. I write pretty frequently for StarCityGames.com. Pretty much was one of the first writers for their website back when they first launched 100 years ago or so. And anyway... I've always been a big fan of multiplayer Magic, but I also was a fan of like standard Magic. So I would sort of alternate between writing about standard over the years, and then I'd mix in some multiplayer. And then when Commander kind of blew up, kind of started gaining in popularity, I started writing about the format and people responded well. And so I've kind of focused in on mostly writing about Commander these days.
Yeah, you've got some really illuminating articles. It was actually Dana and Matt who turned me on to your content on Star City Games, and it's definitely a lot of fun to go through.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Dana, Matt, I take it that you've been following Benny's content for quite a while then.
Yeah, for a couple of years from my end, and I think it was Jason Ault that kind of steered me his direction. I can't remember if it was on Twitter or on Brainstorm Brewery or something, but Jason was a big fan of Benny's, which then got me looking his direction. And, you know, every time an article comes out on Star City Games, it's always a good read. And I do think it's really interesting that you can actually say you were the guy who wrote the book on EDH.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, there wasn't a whole lot of content about Commander. So I tried to write some articles to kind of, you know, explain why you should play the format and, you know, kind of the mindset that makes it a good, fun, enjoyable experience. And I had the good fortune of actually living in the same state as Sheldon Menery. So when he was first sort of evangelizing the format, I got to, you know, hang out with him at tournaments in Virginia and talk about it. So, you know, I kind of heard the word straight from the man, and I liked what he was talking about. So anyway, I just was writing about it. And over the years, people would ask me about some of my older articles. And so at some point I decided to put it in a book, and it was fun.
That's so cool. And I think we were talking about this before the show actually started, but Don Miner, who created EDH Rec, he's a pretty, you know, low key type of dude. But when he heard that you were coming on the show, he got so excited.
Well, that makes me excited because I think his site is fantastic. And in my real world job, I work as a data analyst. So data is kind of my thing. So
very kindred spirits. That's awesome.
Hugs back at him.
So also to maybe help get to know you a little better, Benny, what type of decks do you usually play in Commander?
I like games that everybody can play Magic. You know, like I'm not a big fan of you know, shutting people down from playing their games or, you know, doing a quick combo kill. Like, I want everybody to kind of sit down and play some Magic and hopefully have some fun. Everybody get to play some cards and, you know, whoever wins or loses, like, you know, I want everybody to kind of leave with a smile. That's basically the kind of thing.
So I guess you're actually the opposite of Don Miner then, because he only plays stacks.
Right.
So any specific commanders that are your personal favorites?
Well, I have quite a few different decks because I like to go to big events and play with different people. So, you know, I like to keep things, you know, have a variety of different things to play and hopefully be able to kind of match up with the play style of whoever's playing with. But I guess my old favorite at this point is Felden of the Third Path. I really like that deck and I've had it for quite a while. It actually occurred to me because I'm fairly well known as being a fan of Golgari. And
yes.
And it occurred to me Felden is basically a mono red Golgari deck.
I was just about to say that. I'm the resident necromancer on the podcast. So when you said Felden, I'm like, really? Reviving things from graveyards? Go
don't,
on.
Don't encourage him. Right. Joey needs no more help.
So that's kind of my old favorite. But my new favorite has got to be my mono green Grothoma deck. That deck is just so much fun. And it makes people confused because it's such a weird card.
Well, you have to really think with that commander, too. Like, yeah, you want to draw all the cards in the world when you kill it, but you also, more often than not, are going to have to lose a handful of creatures to do so.
Right.
And then, oh, that's a cool deck.
And then, you know, maybe the Grothoma player has a way of saving his Grothoma from dying, and then you've lost a bunch of creatures, and
right.
And he cackles maniacally.
That's pretty sick. Benny, you mentioned that you go to a lot of events. Are there any events upcoming in the near future that you'll be attending?
There is a Star City Open in Richmond in a couple of weeks that I'm going to try to stop in and see if I can pick up some games of Commander there. And then there's the SCG Con in June in Roanoke, which I'll be there. Actually, I'll be one of the featured guests there in their command zone. I don't know if you've seen the guest lineup, but it's pretty cool.
It is pretty stacked.
There's a lot of cool
yes.
people playing there.
Yeah, that was kind of, I'd already done all my trip planning for the year when that schedule came out, and I was like, oh, come on, I don't know if I can't squeeze one more air flight into, I can't justify that in my budget. Like, sorry, honey, I need to spend a couple $100 on a plane ticket to go to another event.
Yeah.
That's really cool, though. I totally love it. I do want to mention, so we've got a bunch of stuff here that we want to get to on the show today, but I am clearly, as you may have been able to tell from the intro, bursting at the seams to talk about War of the Spark. At the time of recording, obviously the entire set has not been spoiled, so we don't know everything that's out just yet, but I think it would be really cool to talk about at least one card from the set each that, you know, is really personally exciting, a stuff that we're looking forward to. And I'm going to try and restrain myself to only talk about one card because, man, this set looks so darn cool. But I still wanted to make sure that we had that opportunity. And then hopefully in a future show, we'll be able to do a proper set review. But I'm going to pass it over to you guys. Matt, Dana, Benny, what's a card from War of the Spark that you're really excited for so far?
Well, I can go first here. First of all, the set as a whole, you nailed it, Joey. We're like not even halfway through, I don't think, the spoiler season, and it's already absurd. Mm-hmm. I didn't think anything would be able to surpass my hype for Dominaria last year, and this did it. I didn't think it was going to do it. Not that I wasn't looking forward to it, but I'm like, it's going to be good, but like, there's no way it's better than Dominaria to me. And I'm really, really blown away by the set so far. The one card in particular that really has my attention is the Buy a Box promo, Tezzeret, Master of the Bridge. For me in particular, I've got a Dimir deck led by Veil of the Nightclad that's built around artifact creatures, and it's got the other three playable Tezzerets in it. So there's kind of a Tezzeret sub-theme going on. I mean, adding a fourth one just makes sense in that deck. He fits perfectly in a deck because of his passive ability where creatures and planeswalker spells you cast have affinity for artifacts. It's there's like 60 artifacts in a deck. So basically, I play Tezzeret. I can just empty my hand with all these janky artifact creatures that have Intimidate from Vela. It's a perfect fit for the deck. It's a cool card. It brings back an old keyword that we haven't seen in a long time. He's got good abilities. I like Tezzeret as a character. It's everything I want in one card. I'm really excited for it.
That's really legit. Yeah, that guy does look really, really cool. Matt, what about you? What's a card from War of the Spark that's exciting you?
I mean, I'm surprised Dana isn't excited about a Sphinx that doesn't cost 12 mana that he can put in his decks, but, you know.
Or a Death Touch Tribal Planeswalker. It was tough
to
pick.
True. That is true.
Yeah, there's a lot to look forward to.
I mean, so go figure. They have a legendary hound creature, and I'm excited about it. But Mowu, however you want to pronounce his name, little Mowu? Companion. Yeah, Mowu. Him.
Mowu.
The good boy. The best boy.
Cujo.
Cujo. Oh, no, no. No, that's not a good boy. Lassie.
There we go.
Steroids. Lassie did some push-ups and drank some protein and got hella buff. But yeah, any of these legendary hound creatures, I really wanted to like Tolsimir, but he only triggers when wolves enter the battlefield, not when all hounds or dogs or puppers or, you know, any of that enters the battlefield. So I got to go with Mowu. I mean, just legendary dogs. Why not? I probably will have to build another Selesnya deck for Good Boy Tribal.
So Mowu is the one that whenever you put counters on him, he gets additional counters. Is that right?
Yeah. So he's a 3-3 with Trample and Vigilance for 4 mana. If one or more +1/+1 counters be put on Mowu, you may put that many +1 on it instead. And I know for sure he's going to go into my Moldrotha deck for sure. Like, I'll just get a copy and fits in perfectly. +1/+1 counters. Be great.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. There's so much to look forward to in this set, but I have to give my personal shout out to Feather the Redeemed. It was just spoiled today at time of recording. It was just spoiled today by the Command Zone podcast, and I'm so excited. Guys, I have been waiting for like 15 years for this character to get a card. Feather the Redeemed, 1WW for a 3/4 with flying. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell that targets a creature you control, exile that card instead of putting it into your graveyard as it resolves. If you do, you return that card to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. She is so good. This commander opens up so many avenues, and since we're probably going to review her more specifically on a future show, I don't want to get too into the strategy right now, but I do. It's so good. It's so good.
And it is a card that you, on our, a couple episodes ago, you talked about being on your wish list for 2019 even, so... Nice job. You got what you wanted. Now it's time for us to, you know, ransack Wizards and get what we want.
Yeah, I mean, suffice it to say, a lot of people are excited about a low-cost flying commander with aggressive stats who enables a Spellslinger archetype in these colors, and who is powerful even on a super tight budget, and who gives life to combat tricks, a hitherto unplayable spell type in EDH. I mean, maybe you want to go crazy with constant combat tricks, or maybe you want to use tiny spells that each say, like, ooh, target creature gains first strike, draw a card, and then she'll return them to your hand, and then you get tons of extra cards every turn. I don't know, but the point is that there's diversity, there's flexibility, there's epic Raymond Swanland art. I mean, just everything about this is pitch perfect. It's just so cool. And what I especially love isn't just that she's a lore character I've been waiting for like 15 years to finally see in print. I love that she also reminds us to think about card advantage in different terms. It's not just about drawing cards. It's also about resiliency. Like, if your stuff is indestructible and you cast a board wipe, technically that's card advantage because you've got more game pieces. Or if you make like 10 tokens, that's also card advantage because you have more game pieces. But if you cast spells and you don't lose the number of cards in your hand, you're up on card advantage, and Feather does exactly that. Just, oh man, I'm a Sultai man through and through, but holy crap, I am so in love with Feather. That should say something. Okay, I need to stop gushing about this. Benny, what's a card that you're looking forward to from War of the Spark? Because I could turn this into the actual Feather Cup podcast, like, well, I threatened to do with the intro.
Feather is Joey's Anna Kendrick, because she is pitch perfect, like you said.
I'm just trying to figure out how he could have been a fan of this 15 years ago when he was a zygote 15 years ago.
Hey.
Well, I do agree. Feather seems really cool. Like, it really is a neat kind of build around, get your thoughts going and in all kinds of cool new directions with it. I'm looking forward to seeing what people do with it. But the card that kind of caught my eye, I'm a big fan of spell lands that do cool things, and the card that kind of jumped out at me was Emergent Zone. So Emergent Zone taps for colorless mana, and you can also tap it for one and sacrifice it, and then it lets you cast spells this turn as though they had flash. So I'm not the biggest fan of Vedalken Orrery. In fact, it will probably summon an eye roll for me every time someone plays it, because, you know, at that point you're just sort of playing, you know, magic in a way that, you know, doesn't really need a whole lot of thought. You know, you just play the spells, all your spells at optimal speed. But this card, I think, is kind of cool because it lets any deck kind of choose to jump in the fray at any moment. You know, like when there's something going on and some crazy spells are getting thrown around, and if you have this out there, you can crack it and jump in the middle of the stack. You know what I mean? Like, I just think it's going to lead to some really fun plays and some interesting situations that, you know, most decks wouldn't really have the opportunity to do. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this card is gonna make some stories that people are going to talk about. You know what I mean?
And I like what you mentioned there about there being like a dynamic with the choices involved. It's like you're threatening for flash, but you're not sure whether they will. And like that adds an interesting layer into the gameplay too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a cost associated with it, which is you lose the land. So it's a one and done situation, but the person's never sure if you're willing to pull the trigger now. It requires choices on your part. It requires anticipation on your opponent's part. It just leads to interesting gameplay. And I'm always looking for utility lands to add to decks so I can remove even more basic lands just to get Matt to chastise me.
Right.
That's always nice.
Yeah, that's an easy way to do it.
I have that problem too. I tend to put in quite a few colorless lands into my decks, and sometimes I regret that decision. But
this is my mono black deck, and I have two swamps.
Right. How come I can't find a swamp off this? Fetch land. I know I have at least two in here.
Right.
Cool. All right. We've got a couple of other things that we want to run through really quick, too, including a new announcement regarding Architect. Dana, do you want to take this one away?
Yes, I certainly can. Architect, and I'll just read briefly the official announcement. If you are an EDH Rec user, you may have noticed that Architect has been a data source for a little while now. The recommendations on EDH Rec are already part of Architect data, and as of today, which was the 8th of April, they're officially integrated with EDH Rec. So you're going to see more and more options to click on individual cards and add them to your deck, or look at recommendations straight from EDH Rec if you're in the Architect deck builder. It's basically tying that into the site almost like it's part of EDH Rec in a way.
Yeah, this is such a cool announcement, and ever since, Dana, you mentioned that you were using Architect now, I just tried it once and I was instantly in love. This probably sounds like I'm being a sellout or something, but like, no, honestly, I just think that Architect has such an awesome and very user-friendly interface for putting your cards into a deck list online. And I love that they're now going to be using EDH Rec suggestions to assist that and make the building process even easier to do. I just think that's so cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, I've been using it for a while, and I'm not just saying this because, you know, I write for EDH Rec and they're someone that we are now working with as a business. I've been using the website as my exclusive deck builder for like probably 3 months now because it does all the things I want that none of the other deck builder sites all do at the same time. It lets me goldfish out hands, which is something I like to do, and I find it to be really, really useful, is actually able to deal out 7 cards and put them onto a battlefield and draw the next one and make decisions and just kind of get a rough feel for how the first few turns of a deck plays out. That's a big deal to me, and it lets me do that, and that's not something that you find on many other websites. It lets me designate the actual specific version of a card in a deck, and I'm somebody who has a couple foil decks that I'm working on, so being able to specify this deck has this particular version of a card and it is in fact a foil is important to me and my deck builder. So there's things like that. It's got really good stats, has a pretty easy to use interface, and the fact that it's now going to be meshed into the EDH Rec makes it even better. So no, I'm 100% not a fan of the site just because of the integration. I've been using it for a while and it's the real deal. I'm glad that it's now part of EDH Rec because it's even more useful to me than it already was.
Yeah, it's super cool. There are a lot of features, and I also just like the way that it lays out the cards in front of you, to be perfectly honest. Again, I realize I'm sounding like a commercial as I'm talking
about this. Me too.
But like, that's just, it's true. This is how I actually want to talk about it, because I'm just so impressed with how straightforward it is to you. So I just think that's really cool.
Well, I'd like to chime in too, that I use Archidect as well. I think it's a pretty cool, you know, deck database for putting your decks and having links to share with people. So yeah, I concur. It's a great website, and I'm excited that you guys are partnered up with it.
Sweet. Yeah, we have another announcement, though. Kind of a fun project that Don Miner threw together on EDHREC within this past week. Matt, I'm going to let you take this one.
So this one actually is kind of fun, because I probably have come under fire in my playgroups for this. But for the most part of last week, we put up a salt vote. You may have seen it on Twitter, but basically you could go through all the cards in Magic the Gathering and vote on how salty a certain card makes you feel, whether it was stuff like Leovold or Stasis or Brainstorm, because that's a 4 for me automatically, or even Basic Mountain, because you know Blood Moon's coming. So we had that go through. We had over 500,000 votes.
That's half a million people.
Half a million votes. That's like more than the hours that Joey will ever be alive, because...
Wow!
Well, I mean, seconds is how much you've been alive, because that's what, 2 years, 3 years?
Okay, we can go past the age jokes and get to the interesting data now, mister.
But yeah, so we had the votes go through, and after we collected quite a bit of votes, quite a bit of that data that we are kind of known for... We have a list of the saltiest cards in EDH.
Oh, and this is kind of relevant with having Benny on the show, because he's really an advocate for playing fun Magic. in a lot of your columns and your tweets stuff kind of revolve around that. And this is not that. This is the other thing.
I have to say, I think something's wrong with your list here, because I don't see Grave Pact on here.
See, oh, we were talking about that earlier.
We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, this was a really cool project, and people could rate, what was the scale? It was from 0 to 4?
Zero as in no salt accumulated, up to 4, where, oh my gosh, this burns because it's so salty, and don't put it on an open wound.
Yeah, so 0 is like pinch of salt, and 4 is like that planet from The Last Jedi.
Yes, exactly. But we'll just go through a few of the top ones, and we'll pick and choose as we go through. But the results are in, so the top 5 cards, and again, it's out of 4. It's Stasis as the saltiest card, coming in at 3.1 on the salt scale, tied with Armageddon at 3.1. So those are your 1 and 2. Apparently, people don't like it when you mess with their lands.
Huh, weird.
I didn't see that coming. I always wondered why people hated me, but now this kind of makes sense.
Well, that and the no deodorant thing. It's like one of those two, or a combination.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too. Number 3, though, Winter Orb, coming in at a solid 3.0. Number 4, rest in peace, my sweet prince, Leovold, Emissary of Trest, 2.9 on the salt scale. And then number 5, Iona, Shield of Emeria, also at 2.9. Apparently, if you mess with people's lands and you also make sure they can't cast spells, you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah, people don't seem to like that. Not at all. And it's so funny that we included even some banned cards on this particular list, because it was just kind of fun for academic purposes. And it's great to see Leovold up there. I think that's definitely pretty darn accurate. Are you guys surprised by the top 5 of the list? Or
Not really.
I'm not a bit. That seems like exactly ones I would expect to see at the top of the list.
Yeah, I would certainly feel salty if anybody played any of these on me, for sure.
Yeah. I think Benny had a Stasis story, though, he had mentioned off mic that we aren't sure of what it is, but now I'm really curious to hear the
tale.
Oh,
that's right.
Okay, yeah. In my early days of writing about Magic, I wrote for Scry Magazine, and I got to do an interview with Mark Rosewater for Future Sight. I believe it was Future Sight.
That's cool.
But they were doing those Magus cycles, and originally the blue Magus was Magus of Stasis. And
really?
And apparently it didn't play very well.
Shocker.
So then they were like, let's switch it out to Magus of...
I think, was it the Jar? Magus of the Jar from Time Spiral?
Was it Time Spiral?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think
there,
so.
There were a couple of different
no, it
Magi
was,
or something with that block.
Wait, no, Magus of the Future Sight. It was like a Magus of...
Oh, yeah. From the actual Future Sight set, Magus of the Future, who is just the Future Sight, but as a creature.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Lets you play stuff from the top of your deck. Yeah, there's a whole bunch from there. Magus of the Bazaar, Magus of the Jar, a whole bunch of things like that. I am glad that they did not make a Magus of Stasis.
Right.
Because that would be awful.
But I do kind of want to see if the art at all paralleled the original Stasis art. It's like just an abstract wizard. Right. That makes no sense.
Right.
Picasso's wizard.
Right, exactly.
Blank canvas with a couple of geometric shapes.
Yeah, I'm sure if that had gone further, the art director would have had a good time with that.
So a lot of the cards that we're seeing here seem to match expectations, but the list is pretty darn long. We've got a lot of other things on this particular list, like Expropriate and Vorinclex, Time Stretch. Cyclonic Rift comes on this list at a 2.7. Then you've also got things like Static Orb and Devastation. We're seeing quite a commonality here, and it does all, like Matt mentioned, tend to center around the ability to cast your spells. Or, in the case of the extra turn spells, just like other people are sitting at the table waiting and not being able to do anything. So, I mean, I think we're definitely able to see quite a common thread among all of the salty cards. People want to be able to do stuff when they're playing Commander. And a lot of the salty cards are exactly the cards that prevent us from being able to do it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what the list is. I mean, I do think salt is exactly the way to describe it. It's cards that just kind of annoy people. Because some of these aren't even necessarily that powerful, but they're annoying.
Are there any that you take off of the list then?
Take off Tabernacle of Pendril Veil because I'm pretty sure everybody that voted for it, nobody's actually played against it. So
I think that's another banned card, isn't it?
No, it's not.
It is legal.
It's legal. It's just a $1,200 land that doesn't make mana.
Oh, so it's effectively a banned card because of our wallets.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Roughly.
Yeah, I mean, none of them really jump out at me as being things that, like, a few of them I get why they're on here, but I don't think they're necessarily... Like, you know, okay, Seedborn Muse is really, really strong, or, you know, so are the Eldrazi Titans, but, like, I don't get mad when I see any of those.
I think there are a few that kind of surprise me. So, for example, the card Mindslaver, that's sitting at a 2.5 on the list, 2.5 out of 4. I personally would put Mindslaver a lot higher, actually, because there's nothing that I find more frustrating than literally not being able to play my deck. And when someone Mindslavers me, especially if they're playing Duretti and repeatedly doing that, oh man, I'm just like, I'm here to play Magic. I'm not here to watch you play my Magic. And so that's a card that definitely gets under my skin.
Yeah, I would agree with that one. The ones that I'm most surprised, like things like Upheaval aren't a little bit higher. That thing just grinds games to a halt, and there's really no way around it aside from maybe you get lucky and happen to have a counterspell in hand, whereas like I get how Winter Orb's annoying, but it's also something you can deal with. Even Stasis to a degree, for the most part, you can respond. You probably, maybe you don't have any mana free, but like hopefully you'll untap one and then play a land, you know, play a land and maybe have a rock free and you can disenchant it. Whereas Upheaval, just the game is set back 15 minutes. So that one I thought would be higher. And things like Bribery, I'm like, I don't get why that makes anyone mad, but to each his own.
A card that surprises me on this list, it's coming in at 2.3, is Triumph of the Hordes. I guess maybe I shouldn't be too surprised. That's the green sorcery that gives all of your creatures +1/+1 trample and infect. But I gotta be honest, I don't think that Triumph of the Hordes is necessarily more powerful than even, say, like an Overwhelming Stampede. I mean, they both are a sorcery that makes the creatures kill you.
See, I think I was about to say, there looks like there's a theme. A lot of what you see on this list, it's either mass land destruction or it's cards that almost win by themselves. Triumph of the Hordes is definitely one of those cards. I would also say Blightsteel Colossus, it's so hard to interact with Blightsteel, so a lot of times it's just going to win you the game. Expropriate is definitely an example of, if this resolves, that player more than likely is going to win the game just because of that card. So I get it. People don't like it when just one card takes over like a tooth and nail can, because more than likely somebody's just going to go get the same two-card combo and win the game from there. So it makes sense.
I don't know. I'm not too miffed by, like, so I understand extra turn spells, especially Expropriate, because then everyone else is just kind of sitting there doing nothing. But I can totally see, in fact, I'm pretty sure I've been in games where people played an Expropriate, but they weren't able to actually do anything with the extra turn or maybe extra turns that they got, because it is dependent on their board state. And that's also true of Triumph of the Hordes. Like, you have to have creatures for that to work. And if someone else has a fog, like they should, because this is Commander, like they should have some type of Spike Weaver effect or Teferi's Protection effect or anything like that, then they'll be able to, you know, still be safe. And so that's kind of what I meant by saying, like, Triumph of the Hordes is pretty similar to an Overwhelming Stampede. And Blightsteel Colossus, I mean, everyone's got a Swords to Plowshares available. So, like, a lot of these cards, I say a lot of these, a couple of these cards, just sort of don't strike me as being all too threatening or all that salt inducing.
I was a little surprised to see Aura Shards on here at 2.2. I mean, that is an annoying card, but it's not like it's gonna lose you the game on the spot, right?
But it also is one of those ones that I imagine people, somebody sat down and was like, oh, I remember that game against that Gave deck where they put Aura Shards, popped four tokens off it, and destroyed three mana rocks and my one good enchantment. So I think that it has the, I see why it's annoying in some decks. And if you're playing that same dude who has that Gave deck or that, I don't even know what other, I'm not thinking of any big token producers in those, Risa Redeem deck or something, where they're just pooping out tokens constantly. I get why, like, that one person or multiple people probably find that card super annoying, even if it isn't all the time.
Yeah, I would put Food Chain in that same category. It's just a card that, when you read it, you just know it's probably not going to be a good time. You almost know what's going to happen before it even happens. And it's just, I would put that in the same category that Benny puts Vedalken Ori. Like, I'm just going to roll my eyes at you and, you know, hope the game gets over soon.
Wow. So another pretty interesting thing that Don was able to supply us with for this particular topic about the saltiest cards in EDH was also the cards that people seem to disagree the most about. So he also gave us a list with some weirdly weird, complicated standard deviation stuff that I, as an English major, am just not completely able to comprehend. But basically, these were the cards that had the most deviance, where people were not seeming to agree about whether they found the cards very salty or not. So they got, you know, a bunch of votes, people saying, like, oh, this is a 4 on the scale, this makes me super salty. But then it also got a bunch of people who were saying, this is a 0, I don't mind it that much. And that includes cards like Thieves' Auction, Scramble Verse, Epicenter, Possessed Portal, Warp World, cards like that, which I found those to be pretty interesting. You get some weird chaotic cards on that particular list. People can't seem to decide about whether or not these chaotic cards are salt-inducing.
Yeah, some people really love their chaos cards, and some people really hate them, so that totally makes sense.
Which side of the camp do you fall on?
I tend to fall, well, it's kind of hard to say. I'm not the hugest fan of chaos, but I do like to kind of see how it goes, you know? Like, it just can be totally crazy. The chaos that I'm not the biggest fan of are, like, the ones that take forever to resolve and everyone has to get out their phones and read rules and, you know, like, it takes, like, a half hour for everybody to figure out how it's actually going to resolve. But, like, things that just sort of, you know, like, Warp World, I think, is kind of a crazy fun card in a way, because it just, you know, who knows what's going to happen with that. But it resolves relatively quickly.
Well, I will tell you, Joey, I'm somebody who clicked 4 for both Scrambleverse and Warp World when I had them come up for me during the voting process.
I did as well. I'm with Benny. If it takes anything, if it takes longer than a turn to resolve a spell, I usually just go sit and take a nap or something.
Well, at least with the Obliterate that someone casts, something they have some way to win with it. I don't love seeing that or love seeing a Stasis, but I assume when a Stasis comes down, that Teferi player is probably going to win in the next 3 minutes. When the Chaos comes down, I have no idea how long I'm going to be sitting there trying to figure out how I can win when I have to play with my shoe on my head or whatever the card is requiring me to do.
And I think it's not even like the first Chaos card that bugs me. It's the second and third Chaos cards in the same game that just kind of drag it out. And we've talked on the podcast a few times how, you know, we kind of value our time, so we want to get as many games in as possible. And so making games intentionally drag on, it just, for me personally, I'm not terribly interested in that.
Yeah, when it goes from Omen Machine into Warp World into Scrambleverse into...
No, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. I get you there. And it is kind of a weirdness about those cards is that, like, you can get into a state where the only option is to concede because the game mechanics are forcing you to do something, but you can't even like extricate yourself from it. So I can see why people would call it salty, but I can also see, like, I mean, I really hit my stride in the original Ravnica. That's where I got my love of Feather. And so things like Warp World do have almost like a warm, fuzzy, nostalgic feeling for me. So I am starting to understand that division where people couldn't quite agree on those cards.
Well, and I don't even call those salty cards. I call them more sugary cards because that's what I'm going to put in your gas tank after I scoop from the game.
Wow. All Dana right. just admitted to crimes of some sort, I'm sure.
I'm sure Ken will edit that out, so I'll be fine.
I don't want him to at this point. Alrighty. So those are definitely really cool, interesting numbers. Listeners, you should totally go look at the final list for the saltiest cards in EDH because I think they're pretty darn interesting. But now we also want to talk a bit more about Benny and your articles because, I mean, hey, that's why you're here. So how about you walk us through it? What is the mission of your articles? What's the stuff that you like talking about every week when you're writing for Star City Games?
Well, the main thing that I like to do is to cover the new commanders. I tend to get hyped over almost every new legend that comes out, and I have all kinds of ideas, and so I want to sort of write into the hype and get other people excited about these cards and, you know, get some conversations going. So I sort of make it my mission to cover at least, you know, the most exciting of the new legends from every set. You know, and then when there's some downtime, I'll try to, you know, do something a little different, you know, maybe some strategy articles, or I've been doing a commander contrast and compare that's been kind of fun lately, where I ask somebody in the Magic community what their favorite commander is currently, and then I'll build a deck around that commander, and then I'll bump it up against their build and kind of talk about how we differ and how we have the same kind of thing. So that's been kind of fun.
That's really neat. And I think Dana mentioned earlier, a big take, a big spin in your articles is always the focus on fun. Definitely a contrast from all the salty cards that we were just talking about.
Yeah. That's definitely, I get kind of upset when people like to play the cards that shut other people down. I think that's not a healthy approach to the social format, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that was one reason one of your recent articles, I believe it was Why You Should Play Commander Like Me. It was basically, here's how I interpret the social contract, if you will, and why do I make deck building choices the way I do, et cetera. And it really resonated with me personally because I consider myself a fairly spiky player in games, but deck building wise in that process, I definitely try to lean more towards that Timmy aspect just to make sure I'm not doing crazy broken things. I might try to play them right in game, but I try to build with fun in mind.
Well, and I think even, I mean, you can still couple having fun and winning together too, I guess depends on your mindset. But for me, myself, it's way more satisfying for me to win a game when the other person's gotten a chance to play their deck out than it is to win a game when they haven't. Like, I want the person to be at full strength. I want them to do all their things. I want the deck to be able to show me the thing it's trying to do. Because number one, that's interesting. And number two, then they've enjoyed themselves. And number three, when I actually win then against the deck that's done that and the person has got to do their thing, that is a much more satisfying victory.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if everybody's had a shot and you manage to maneuver through, you know, the ebb and flow of crazy game of Commander, like, nothing's sweeter than coming out on top at the end, for sure. But it's all, you know, it's all that interaction that's so much fun. And, you know, whether you win or lose, like for me, I tend to try to redefine what winning is for me. I mean, like, winning the game of Magic, that's kind of, you know, and the Magic rules say there's going to be one winner at some point. So the game should naturally progress in that direction. But, you know, if you set other things that for you are winning, other than just winning the game, then you're always going to be winning. You know, every time you sit down to play Commander, you're going to be winning the game. If you, you know, if it's just having some fun, seeing some cards that you've never seen before, or some kind of card interaction that you had never thought of. You know, all those different things that just kind of make sitting down with people, especially people you may not play with all the time, you know, those surprises are what makes, for me anyway, I think Commander such a great format.
Yeah, there's a lot of value in a good story from a game. Mm. Like there's a lot of games I've lost that I remember specifically things that happened in that game, versus there's plenty of games I've forgotten that I've won because nothing crazy or interesting happened. So that's a win in a lot of ways, playing a game where you've seen something really funny or weird or crazy or an amazing play that has a lot of value. And I think people need to learn to maybe appreciate that aspect of quote unquote winning versus actually just coming out on top.
Yeah, it kind of, I'm struggling for a way to exactly put this into words, but really when there's an opportunity for a game night with all of your friends, you could play any game. And if you're going to play one game where one person has just trampled over everyone else because they are playing some stacks and no one got to do anything, it kind of begs the question, well, why didn't we play a board game that is specifically designed for everyone to have their shot? And so that's, I do like that, starting not just like, you know, the fun in the game, but starting from like your actual deck and making sure that you're building it like it could be another board game where it's designed for everyone to have their shot and for you to still win despite all those things. I'm not sure if I'm doing a great job of articulating that, but it is just a good thing to keep in mind. We want to play Magic and we want to make sure that it's a game experience that is superior to any other game that we could be playing, because Magic is the best game. But that does involve a little bit of, you know, intention on our part too when we're actually putting the decks together.
Yeah, and I'll put this caveat out there that what's fun isn't the same for everybody. So if your particular playgroup defines fun as playing a really brutal stacks game where no one has room to breathe and the first person that manages to fight through it and get one thing in play can turn the tide and win the game, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing that type
cool
of game
strategy
style
to that kind of
for
game.
Sure. And if everyone's on board with that, I absolutely think that that's fantastic. But I think if you're sitting down with strangers that you don't know that well, the odds that they're all into that versus that they're all into getting to play their deck, I think you're much better erring on the side of assuming they want to play their deck a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you can definitely play all kinds of different forms of Commander. It's just the format is designed to be very sociable. So I think if you err on the side of just letting everybody play Magic, if those are the kind of decks you build at home, and then you just take the decks to the game shop or to, you know, a Star City Open or Grand Prix or something, then the odds are you're going to still have, people are going to have fun with you playing those kind of decks too.
So let me ask you guys this. In each of your opinions, what is the deck that you personally have the most fun playing? And I guess also, if you are now imagine that you're your opponents, what do you think they think is your most fun deck to play against? Are those two different decks?
That is a good question.
So for me, just as an example, like I love Necromancy. Marin and Mimeoplasm are both some of my absolute favorite things to do because I'll put a bunch of creatures into the graveyard and I'll bring them all back out. But by no means do I think that I'm do I think that that's the most fun deck for my opponents to play against? It can certainly be very interactive, but when I'm, I don't know, grave pacting them completely out of having any creatures or board state or anything like that, that's not necessarily as much fun. Compare that to like my group hug deck where I've got a bunch of stories from playing that deck, and it is literally designed for everyone to enjoy the game together, for everyone to be able to ramp up and to do what their deck is supposed to do. And then it's also designed to still try and navigate to a win despite letting everyone do their thing. So I feel like if I'm imagining my opponent's perspective, they would much prefer to play against something like Kanea Sentiro as opposed to something like my Marin. So I do think that there is a difference there. It's just kind of interesting to note. Are there any examples that you guys can think of? A deck that you personally have fun playing, but that you think your opponents have fun playing against as a different deck?
So I also have, in my mind, my most fun deck for my opponents is my KNT deck as well.
Yes.
But I don't really have it built as a group hug deck because I think the commander itself is enough of a group hug so that he just basically, his ability helps everybody kind of play their game more, you know? And so I can fill the deck with a bunch of cards that I enjoy playing because it's four colors. So, you know, you can cover a lot of ground with that. But, you know, I think everybody enjoys drawing extra cards, playing extra lands. And it just kind of just inherently carries the game forward so that even if somebody's kind of stalling out on their land drops or cards or whatever, it kind of helps them along. And so I generally, whenever I play that deck, it seems like everybody has a pretty good time with it. So that's sort of, I think I view that as sort of a crowd pleaser deck that I also enjoy playing with too. I would probably say that my personal favorite deck currently is Grathoma, mainly just because of its weirdness. I just, I love all the weird interactions with that deck. And I actually had at the SCG Con in December, I had Gavin Verhey play the Grathoma deck in a game and watched him do some crazy things that I didn't even think about. That's a very smart dude.
You said a word there that I actually also kind of want to highlight. You had mentioned interaction, and I think when I'm sort of, you know, mentally analyzing my Kaneos and Tiro deck, one of the things that is really, really very, very dense in that deck is the amount of interaction that I have. I've got a bunch of different spells that, you know, will benefit a creature or that will remove a creature or a whole bunch of stuff. Like, that is one of my most interactive decks. And I think that is also a really key ingredient to having a really fun experience for everyone at the table, because you've got more of the actual dynamicism of a typical one-on-one game when you have more things like removal spells or instant speed interaction and things like that. I think that's probably a pretty key piece as well when you're looking for a fun, mutually enjoyable play experience for the whole table.
Yeah.
Those interactive spells.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think for me, I think that's a good point about a deck being fun for you maybe isn't the thing other people would say is the most fun, because I would say the deck I probably tend to enjoy most is my Glissa the Traitor deck.
Yes.
Because it's highly interactive. I've got a gazillion things going on. I mean, to the point where I don't play it after 10 o'clock at night because I can't manage the triggers. I'm just, my brain isn't functional enough to keep track of it, though. It's become like a shop rule. Like, it's past 10, you can't play that deck. But by the same token, there's so much going on, and, you know, it's got all death touch creatures in it, which makes it difficult maybe for other people to swing at me or do what they want to do. And it can lend itself to being a little bit dirtily because of that. You know, when I'm, okay, guys, I've got a Executioner's Capsule out and I can, you know, blow my mana and wipe the board, but it's going to take me, well, you know, we need to play through the whole thing. And I've got a Thornbite Staff and a Viridian Longbow on Glissa right now, and that's going to chain the board down, but I need to make sure anyone can't respond to it. So, I mean, I've had a friend who jokingly said the deck gives him PTSD.
Wow.
I totally realize why that might not be the most fun to play against either. So I would say of my decks, probably my Recce deck is probably the most fun to play against because the turns are quick. What it's doing is fairly straightforward. I'm not dirting around and taking turns unless maybe I get to that point in the game where it's going to kind of storm off and I'm going to play 14 creatures and then give them all haste and kill somebody because of Dragonthorn of Tarkir or something. So I think that one is probably the best because it's just a clean deck to play, and there's so many wonky, bad green legends in it that I think that's probably generally kind of enjoyable too, to constantly see, like, what is that garbage card you just played from Visions? It's a green legend, man. It draws me a card. That's why I'm playing it. Like, so I think that tends to be, people tend to have a good reaction to that too. So I hadn't really thought about it before, but those two things aren't always the same. That's a good point.
Yeah. Matt, what about you?
My favorite to play against, I think people probably say either Omnath, because there's a little bit of a group hug to it. There's, you know, Collective Voyage and those types of cards that, because I want to do more with the lands than everybody else. So everybody, apparently you're not supposed to mess with their lands, but if you give them lands, it has the inverse effect. But yeah, my Miri deck, it's just kind of, it's might be a little battle cruisery. It still can win games, definitely, but for the most part, it kind of does its own thing and takes care of a few key threats, but lets people play their game plan out. I'd say either one of those two. I know it definitely was not my Edgar deck, because that was not fun to play with or against. So,
well, and that, I guess, begs the question, the opposite question, really. Do you have a sense of what people might think your least fun deck would be?
Whew. I know for a little bit there, whenever I pulled Muldrotha out, people kind of rolled their eyes because Muldrotha just has that reputation. So yeah. That's why I really wanted to change up the theme to it. Still have to show off the fact that I'm smarter than Joey.
Hey.
Because I do have a pre-release foil Muldrotha because I am.
Because you won that bet. Yes, I know.
But Muldrotha now is a lot more fun to play against. I think the two that might be the least fun to play against is either Niv-Mizzet, because that's probably my most tuned and competitive deck. Taysa gets a couple side eyes, but I have kind of powered down that because I don't find Dictate of Erebos, Grave Pact strategies terribly fun or interactive, especially in Taysa decks. So I don't have those in there. It still can do some grindy things, but it's not near as optimal as some players would say it should be. So, but yeah, I would probably say of my current living decks, Niv-Mizzet is probably the least fun to play against.
For me, at present, I wonder if one of my least fun might actually be my Mimeoplasm, because the goal of that deck is to immediately entomb and then reanimate really awesome creatures like Jyn Gitaxias or Vorinclex, which, as we saw, were on the saltiest cards at like 3.1 or 3.3 or something like that. So I think people probably don't like that one very much. You mean you don't like it when my Jyn Gitaxias that I pumped out on turn two makes you discard your hand? I'm sorry, but it's one of my absolute most fun to play. And that dichotomy is really interesting. It does require looking through your opponent's eyes to make sure that everyone is having a good time. And, you know, for them to increase their interaction is definitely something cool, too. And that's how you improve as a playgroup. But it's also just a good thing to be conscious of, because that's the point of game night, is for all of us to have fun.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that's a thing that people maybe don't take into consideration enough when they build a deck, is just, is this going to be fun to play against?
So then I've got another question for everyone. Have any of us removed cards from our decks or deleted decks entirely from our arsenal for the sake of other people's fun?
So I had a Marisol deck when the, was it Commander 2017, I think, that had the wizards in it. So Marisol, are y'all familiar with that card?
Yeah, the cage counters. It gets a bunch of activated abilities.
Yeah.
It's the one where you exile like that this bad common from the masks block that I'm never gonna remember what it does, and then you've got four different things like that I can't remember what any of them do, and then I'm just like, all right, I don't know what's happening.
And then suddenly a combo somewhere.
Right, and then I just lose.
Yeah, so like that was such a fun deck building experience. I mean, just doing the research and finding weird old cards that are so horrible, and yet when you exile them and Marisol can use the abilities, like it just does all kinds of interesting things. So I remember being so excited about building this deck and hunting down all the cards and digging through boxes of old cards that I hadn't looked at in ages, and you know, just the process of building that deck. And then when I started playing it, it was like either I drew the cool cards and Marisol started doing its thing and basically shut down everybody else from being able to do anything, which made them all miserable, or they would kill Marisol and keep it off the board, and then I had a handful of terrible cards that didn't do anything, and then I was having a terrible time. So I ended up just dismantling that deck after like maybe two nights of playing it, because nobody was having fun, really.
Yeah, I do think that linearity can be a thing that definitely prevents us from having fun. I had a similar experience when I built Yidris Maelstrom Wielder, and that was awesome because I would hit people and then I would cascade and cascade, and then maybe I'd get an additional combat step and then I'd double cascade, and it was super cool. But that deck operated almost exclusively at either 0 miles per hour or 100 miles per hour, which meant that either I didn't have my commander doing anything throughout the game and I just kind of sat there, or when it did work, I was playing solitaire and everyone else was just watching me. And that wasn't very fun at all, so I ended up dismantling the deck.
Yeah, I would say the two primary reasons I take a deck apart is because it's not fun for me to play, which is usually because it winds up being too dirtily or doesn't have a way to actually get anything done in the game, or because it's annoying for other people. And you can usually tell pretty quickly And I mean, I've taken apart, you know, a dozen different decks for those reasons. The most recent was probably a Tesa Orzhov Scion deck that was an interesting deck and I enjoyed building it. It was built around creatures that I could recur from the graveyard. So I would, you know, Reassembling Skeleton, for example, or Blood Gas kind of thing, where I could sacrifice a creature and make tokens off both Tesa, and there's multiple other variants on Tesa that when a creature dies, you make a 1/1 spirit token of some sort. So that's what it was trying to do, sacrifice creatures that I could recur to sack again to make a, you know, eventually a swarm of tokens. It was basically a token deck. The problem was it was super, super, super dirtily. And while it wasn't oppressive, because I wasn't running Grave Pact kind of effects, there was just no situation where for me to get in a position to win with the deck, it didn't involve me taking a 10-minute turn of trying to flip things in and out of the graveyard, maximize my mana to get the most of them out. And, I mean, maybe I would have Cathar's Crusade out and I could just ask if anyone had a response and we could assume I was going to win. But very frequently that wasn't the case and I had to just see if I could make 35 tokens. And yeah, so it wasn't a good time for anybody to sit there and watch me do that. And it wasn't a good time for me to do all of that. So that was the most recent one, but I've had plenty of decks that I've taken apart for similar reasons where I just knew nobody was going to want to play against it. Not even because it was oppressive, just because it was boring.
Yeah, gotcha. So, okay, we talked a bit this episode about like salty cards and now also paying attention to other people's, you know, their fun levels and things that we do to make sure that everyone's having fun. But I don't want to just talk about salt. I mean, Dana, you'd mentioned sugar earlier too. So I've got one last question for you guys. Like, what would you put if we were making a sugar list? Like, what's number one for you? Like your favorite card to play?
I need to think, that's fine, it's
a bonus question, so
like a serious one, like legitimately we love to put it out. I think mine recently definitely would be Psychic Possession, which is a four. Did I mention that? No, I did not. It's a 4-mana enchantment that enchants a player, and whenever they draw a card, you draw a card. And
oh yeah,
it doesn't see a lot of EDH play. It's from the original Ravnica block. And whenever I play it on somebody who hasn't seen it before, which is almost all the time, if unless they've seen it from me playing it, they have to read it like 2 or 3 times to figure out what's going on. And then they tend to look down at their hand and then look back at the card. And it's never not hilarious as they like realize, wait a minute, I'm holding, like the first time I ever cast it, the dude did that and then showed me his hand and he had like a Brainstorm and a Faithless Looting and something else. It never fails to generate those kind of plays because, yeah, it's a you know, genuinely a decent card to play, but the person you put it on almost always has that good reaction where they're like, oh, really? Oh, because they can feel their own cards kind of being turned against them, but not in a way that takes something away from them. So the card just always generates pretty good reaction, both because it's weird and old and because of what it does.
That's awesome. I think for one of my personal favorites, it's probably going to have to go to Disrupt Decorum. That's the 2 red-red sorcery, goad all creatures you don't control. And then you just get to comfortably sit back and watch your opponents tear each other apart without really having any control over it. I mean, that encourages tons of interaction, just not with me, with each other. So then you get to watch people get really angry. It was like, why are you attacking me? No, you should attack the other person. And they just can't hit you because they were goaded. And it's just really, really awesome. Because then you just get to watch your puppets dance. All right, so
Benny, what do you think?
Yeah, it's hard for me because I get excited about so many different cards. But I guess one card that I just love putting in decks and always does good things for me is Mirror Pool. Just being able to copy a creature or a spell like at an opportune time just. Like never fails to just make me happy. I actually played it in Standard while it was around. I had a deck that ran Uvenwald Hydras, so I could fetch up Mirror Pools and then use the Mirror Pools to copy the Hydra to get more Mirror Pools. So those kind of shenanigans go well in Commander style too. And actually, I was just thinking of when I mentioned Gavin was playing my Grathoma deck. I have a Stuffy Doll in that deck, and Gavin actually copied Stuffy Doll with Mirror Pool, and then was attacking with 2 Stuffy Dolls with, you know, basically fighting Grathoma.
That's genius. That's such a cool interaction. Oh, the stuffy doll, that's a clutch pick for that deck. Nice choice.
Yeah, so he had two different opponents that were getting hit in the face for 10, you know, each time the stuffy dolls attacked. It was pretty gross.
I super love that. Matt, what about you? Sugar card?
I mean, it's cliche to say Rishkar's expertise at this point, so.
Fair enough.
I think one of the most fun cards, actually, that it was actually pretty high on the salt scale. Humility is a card because I play just a ton of creatures in every deck.
No.
So humility for me, just special place.
Wow. Okay.
Humility is a great card, but that's absolutely one where I sometimes look at the board. Like, I don't see it that much, but when I see it, I look at the board state and go, yeah, no, I'm just going to scoop because I don't want to think this much. It's 11:30 at night and the caffeine's worn off and I just can't.
Yeah, sometimes it just reads 4 mana, win the game.
Yeah, bro, that's
fine.
For sure.
It's fine with me.
You're the worst. Okay. Let's move out of that subject and into our final segment, Challenge the Stats. We're going to look at the data on EDHREC and maybe challenge it a little bit. Look at card that we think is maybe seeing too much play or maybe too little play. Dana, do you mind starting us off?
I certainly can. I'm going to mention a creature originally appeared in Cold Snap. It's in just over 2,000 decks on EDH Rec. It's Oran Viper. It's green and a colorless for a snow creature, snake. So you can actually utilize things that care about snow, like the thaw. Is it thawing glacier? No. What's the land there where you reveal snow permanent off the top?
Glacial Chasm? No, that's not.
Not Chasm.
It's a very obscure card, is the point.
I've just brain farted on it. But anyway, you can technically use it for that. But the reason it's actually a pretty good card, whenever it deals combat damage to a creature, destroy that creature at the end of combat. So it basically has Death Touch on a 1/3. But whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you may draw a card. So particularly early game, but plenty of times even later in the game, people don't always have chump blockers or don't have things they want to lose, and they're just not willing to trade one damage for losing that big beater they have out, so they'll just take the one and let you draw a card. I never ever regret having it in hand in my Glissa deck. That's where I run it, and I mean, I can't think of the last time I played it and it didn't draw me at least one or two cards before a board wipe eventually killed it. I think it's a really, really useful card, and it's only in 2,000 decks.
Only 2,000. Wow. I would have expected it to be more. I'm not as in love with Oran Viper as you are, but I do think 2,000 is low.
I really like that card. I played with it in Standard. I think the biggest problem that card has is that it's 3 mana and it's green.
Three is a good amount. Yes.
And there's so many good 3 mana cards in Commander. Like, you know, like I don't know how many times I've put Oran Viper into my stack of cards that I'm sort of building from, and then inevitably it gets set to the side, and it makes me sad because it is such a cool card.
And it occasionally keeps my Ophiomancer from making me Death Touch saves.
Right.
Wow. Alrighty, I'm going to go on to mine next. Mine is seeing even less play than Dana's pick. That's the card Wake the Dead. So this is an X black instant. You can cast Wake the Dead only during combat on an opponent's turn. And it says that you return X target creature cards from your graveyard to the battlefield, and then you sacrifice those creatures at the beginning of the next end step. This currently only shows up in 1,700 decks, which strikes me as very low considering that it came from the original Commander 2014 product. I didn't know whether I was going to take a chance on this card when I was building Tesa Karlov, who doubles Death Triggers. But I did put it into my Tesa Karlov, who doubles Death Triggers deck. And when I drew it, it was the most exciting thing that I ever could have possibly drawn, because I had like 4 creatures in my graveyard. And then during combat on an opponent's turn, he wasn't even attacking at all, but I could still cast it when he was passing through his combat phase. I revived just a bunch of creatures from the graveyard, like a Reliquary Monk, and I ended up getting 2 Death Triggers off of that to destroy 2 artifacts or enchantments. I got Grave Titan back, which gave me a bunch of zombies. I was able to get, I think it was Massacre Worm as well, so I just got Enter the Battlefield effects. And since I had Tesa out, all of those things were doing double duty on death triggers. I was able to get, I think, an Archon of Justice as well, so I could exile two permanents. And that probably sounds like a magical Christmas land scenario, but Taysa loves killing her own stuff. She loves getting death triggers. So I think Wake the Dead definitely deserves to see play if you're running specifically a Taysa deck. But also if you just like graveyard stuff, this is a surprisingly cool instant that can give you a bunch of either enters the battlefield effects, or, especially in Taysa, leaves the battlefield effects, and it would double all those with Taysa. Super, super clutch. I was able to bring an opponent from 30 life to like zero in one turn using Wake the Dead. And I'm really happy about that. So I think that more people should give that card a shot.
Yeah, the fact that it's instant speed is a big deal. Like, it's, you would assume that was going to be a sorcery speed effect, but the fact that it's instant adds so many variables.
I can see why traditional Reanimator decks are maybe less keen on it, because usually Reanimator wants to keep the creatures in play after it revives them. But when you're looking for death triggers like Taysa is, then I think it's pretty clutch.
That is a great choice. I like that.
All right, Benny, how about you? What's your challenge?
All right. So to the surprise of probably no one, I am horrified to see that Temple of the False God is being played is showing up in 103,000 decks.
That's a lot of
on decks. EDH Rec. That is just insane. This land was originally printed in Scourge, and unfortunately, you know, it should have just stayed there. But then they started printing it in each of the Commander products, and so they kept, I guess people kept putting them in their Commander decks, and it's such an inconsistent land. It gives you extra mana when you really don't need the extra mana.
Yeah, only when you have five lands does it tap for two, but otherwise it does stow nothing.
Right? Like, you want, I mean, I have stopped playing this card years ago and have never felt sad about it, and I try to preach the gospel of just replacing it with a basic land, and you'll be happy.
And man, we were looking through some of our previous Challenge the Stat picks, and we talked about Temple of the False God before on our old segment Head to Head, but we'd never actually officially challenged it. So I'm glad that you're here to, you know, keep us in check.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess people look at it and they think, hey, it's gonna tap for two mana, or hey, I'll just use it as a ramp spell that can't be countered. And, you know, I can see why that would sound good, but, you know, you just don't want to draw that card as one of your early land drops, because then you're just floundering, you know? So, I mean, even though the upside is nice, you know, from going from 5 to 6 lands, or 5 to 6 mana, you know, on turn 5, it sounds good, but is really having 5 mana that much worse than having 6 mana at that point? You know, like, the upside I don't think is so good that it warrants the downside of playing a card like that.
Yeah, that is a deck building risk for sure.
Well, I think that's a good point that you mentioned it being in the precons too, because speaking as a kind of novice EDH player, at the time when the 2014 precons came out, I think, you know, I've been playing for a year or two at that point in time, but I didn't think Temple of the False God was a good card, and I was not running it. And then that batch of precons came out that all had Temple of the False God, and I remember actually being like, oh, okay, well, maybe it is a good card, and I was just evaluating it wrong. So I put it in a bunch of decks. Like, I think that's a legitimate thing by jamming it in all those precons. I think it has... It does kind of screw with people a little bit, and it changes how good they think it is, because they just assume, oh, it's one of those cards you run, and they run it.
Yeah, I feel like that the card has probably been pulled well with Wizards, is why they're putting it in. They put it in their precon decks, I guess. I'm not entirely sure, but.
And maybe the thought process is too, well, that's a natural upgrade at some point when you get to be a, you know, more advanced player, you'll swap that out with Ancient Tomb or something. So maybe that's the thought process.
Hmm. Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Yeah, and Commander games do tend to run longer, so it's a safe bet that a card like that will almost always provide you the 2 mana. But you're right, it being an early land can definitely screw you over.
Oh, for sure. You know, the early games in Commander can be kind of clutch. You know, especially if somebody has played a Sol Ring. You know, and if you're stalling out on land because your fourth land is a Temple of the False God, then that person that got the Soul Ring jump is just so much farther ahead than you.
Yeah, I think I agree with your assessment that I'd rather have some form of ramp spell in that slot. That makes a lot of sense to me. Alrighty, Matt, we're going to finish up with your challenge of stats.
So, with War of the Spark coming out here soon, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of Super Friends decks roaming the place tables. And I was recently, well, not so recently, but Joey may have called me out on a couple statements about a card. So I just want to make sure people know that Ghostly Prison and Propaganda currently show up in 15% plus of all Super Friends decks, and do not expect them to save your Planeswalkers.
Yeah.
Just a little friendly reminder that it reads creatures can't attack you unless their controller pays the 2 mana. Not Planeswalkers you control, but you personally. So if you're looking for some way to discourage people from attacking your Planeswalkers, don't count on those 2 cards.
Yeah, something like a Sphere of Safety. That one does specifically mention Planeswalkers, but also you can run just really good defenders like a Fog Bank or a Guard Gomazoa in those slots instead, because those will definitely keep your Planeswalkers alive. But yeah, that's a really good thing to note. Ghostly Prison and Propaganda are not going to help all those new walkers from War of the Spark.
No, not at all. They're, like I said, they're showing up in 17 and 15% of all Super Friends style decks. That's fine and all, but just make sure you're aware and be a little more intentional, like we always talk about, of, is this going to save my Planeswalkers? No, it is not.
And you know, people are like, you know, okay, I guess I'll attack your Planeswalkers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Alrighty, well, this was really cool. Benny, thanks so much for coming on to the show. We really appreciate having you.
Oh, thanks a lot. I had a great time. Hope we can do it again.
Is there anything else that you'd like to leave off on about fun in Commander, or maybe even salty cards or sugary cards, before we head out?
Just, you know, have some fun playing Commander, you know. Play a little less reactive cards and play a little bit more proactive cards, and smash your proactive plan against other people's proactive plan and see what happens.
Yeah, I love it. And on that, I think we're going to call this episode to a close. I'd like to thank my co-host so much for joining me. And if any of our listeners would like to get in touch with us, where can they find you all? Matt?
You can find me on the Twitters at Mathimus55, MathimuS55.
And Dana?
You can find me on Twitterbirds at Dana Roach. And you can hear me twice a week now, apparently, on the other podcast, CMDR Centro.
And Benny, where can our listeners find you?
I'm on Twitter at Blair Witch Green, and you can find me at starcitygames.com every week, pretty much every week, week in and week out.
Awesome. Yeah, you can check out the saltiest cards on EDH Rec now with all of those awesome votes to figure out what are the most salt-inducing cards, and you can go find Benny on Star City Games. And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz on Twitter. Special thanks to our editor for the show, Ken Peddle, also known as Kenneth Schnorn. You can follow him on Twitter at Loader. That's LOAD3R. You can follow EDH Rec and the cast on Facebook and Twitter, and you can contact us at edhreccast@gmail.com, or you can find us on iTunes. And if you do, please consider leaving us a review to help other folks find the podcast as well. This cast is posted every week on our community content spotlight section, where we feature as many other content creators as we can, from Command Zone to Commander's Brew to Commander Versus, not to mention new articles published every day by our own fantastic team of writers. We'll be back at you next week with more data and feather. But until then, remember, EDH wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.
I'd rather have a rampant growth on turn 3, you know, than a Temple of the False God, right?
Here's the only positive thing I'll say about Temple of the False God. I've liked it in the past in decks when I have a Cabal Coffers, because I can just set it aside next to the Cabal Coffers and be like, oh, there's my activation for Cabal. Like, that's the one upside it has, is I can be super lazy and not have to set aside 2 lands for my Cabal Coffers. I can just set aside 1.
Yeah, I've taken to using them as dividers in my card boxes.
How do you really feel about this card? Benny, I'm curious. I don't think we've gotten the truth.
Oh, man.
I know. I've been holding back, guys.